Yegor is coming for dinner tonight. You know Yegor.
Really? Cool. Yeah. Of course I know. Please say hello to you.
Will do. He moved to Amsterdam.
Yeah. I was talking to him a couple of weeks ago. Cool. Wow. Good for him.
Hey Slavic Connection listeners, it's Michelle. I'm here with a special guest host, Anton Shingaryov, who is a political scientist, media relations expert. And today we got to talk with Piotr Sauer, who is a Moscow correspondent from The Guardian.
It was really nice talking to Piotr about his experience working as a journalist in Moscow, about his friend Evan Gershkovich, and about media and the future of Russia.
Brought to you by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies and the William P. Clinton Center for National Security at the University of Texas at Austin. All right, thank you so much for joining us. And we just wanted to start out by asking you about yourself, about why you picked journalism, and why Russia especially. Give us the overview of your history.
Sure. My name is Piotr Sauer. I'm a Russia correspondent for The Guardian. You know, I've sort of quite a long history with Russia because that's where I grew up. You know, I was basically born in Russia in 1992. My parents are Dutch, but they were also journalists who moved to Russia, or what was at the time the Soviet Union, in 1989 as journalists, and they decided to stay. So, you know, Russia was always, growing up, that was everything I knew. I went to Russian school. My native language became Russian. At home I'd speak Dutch, but otherwise Russian childhood. And then eventually I did do some of my studies abroad in the Netherlands to get some sort of connection with that country. But Russia always, fascinated me, and I knew I always would end up back in Russia. And eventually in 2015, I moved back to Moscow to studying abroad and started first as a young journalist at the Moscow Times, which sort of is this Moscow-based English language newspaper, which is really a training school for journalists. I think many, many of the journalists that now work for bigger papers, they started at the Moscow Times, and it's like this amazing place. And after a few years, I joined The Guardian. And unfortunately, when the war started, I had to leave. And since then, I've been in Amsterdam. So this is my short bio.
So you started your journalist career in 2015, already after the Crimea. So what were your expectations professionally about being a journalist in Moscow?
Yeah, I mean, I actually never really wanted to go into journalism because I thought it was a bit cliche. My family worked in journalism. So I think many don't always want to do exactly the same as your parents. So I did some work for international organizations, some internships at the Dutch embassy. I worked as a diplomat for a bit. I worked at the political consultancy for a bit. You know, everything surrounding Russia and the post-Soviet region, but not in journalism. But still, sort of at the back of my mind, I always had journalism as something that maybe I would end up doing. And I think the moment I started with the Moscow Times, I realized that, writing stories, investigating stories was by far the thing I enjoyed most. So when I arrived in Moscow, I actually started a bit later in 2017. I came back to Moscow in 2015, but I started with the Moscow Times in 2017. Of course, it was a completely different Russia than it is today. You know, it was not a free country, but you could do a lot. You could do things that now seem completely unimaginable, of course. You know, starting 2017, it was a time when street protests were something that, was considered normal and frequent. You know, every weekend, for example, in the 2019 summer protests in Moscow, every weekend you come together, you cover the protests, you see your fellow journalist friends there. You know, some people get arrested, but in the end they get detained. There's all these sort of cat and mouse games with the police. Of course, you know the seriousness of what people were protesting, but, it felt like a really different era where people, in Moscow could still go out on the streets and voice their opinions and shout. And often it was quite an uplifting atmosphere. You know, so these were, I think, in the beginning, looking back on it now, to think that, 20,000, 30,000 Moscovites would come every weekend in the summer to, you know, to voice their opposition to the regime seems, you know, completely unimaginable right now. Of course, a lot of that changed. I think the first thing that changed was COVID, which made everything much harder. And it changed my work completely, you know, from going out and talking to people. It was much more focused on, you know, investigative stuff online and you know, calling and using the internet. But I think before COVID, I really enjoyed the way you could report in Moscow.
Let me ask you about the protest. One of the big questions now to Russians being in Russia, why do not they protest against the war? There were big expectations in the beginning that there's going to be a big protest on the streets of Moscow, but it were just dozens of people, basically, possibly hundreds. So why isn't it massive?
Well, I think the risks are just too big, you know, the risk versus the reward element. You know, I don't think Russia is unique in this in that sense. You know, there are countless of authoritarian countries where a lot of people are against what's going on, but in the end, you know, you choose your own safety, and when you realize that if you go out and only voice your opinion, you can get jailed for 5, 6, 7, 8 years without the obvious reward that something will change in Russia. I think for many people, it's very discouraging. I think many people did show their opposition by, you know, by leaving the country, by refusing to pay taxes, you know, by fleeing, mobilization. So I think they find different ways to express opinion. But I think it's you know, it's a bit arrogant and unfair, I think, for many in the West to, you know, criticize all Russians for not protesting. Of course, I think many expected more opposition, and I think many in Russia did buy into, you know, into the propaganda about the war. But, you know, I think there's just a lot of people that are against the war, but find it just too dangerous for various reasons to go out and protest. And you know, I'm a journalist. I'm not supposed to judge. But if I was a Russian, would I go out and protest? I don't know, because, you know, there's a lot of risks.
Yeah. Well, since you switched gears to talking about the war, where were you, you know, on February 24th? And what was it like those first days after the invasion? And how soon were you, did you feel the need to leave Russia?
I was, you know, I was behind my desk. You know, I still remember, you know, I think I'll remember that day forever. You know, I think leading up to the war, it started to become more real and real, and, you know, your sources are starting to tell you that it probably will happen. And the day before, you know, all our sources said that it will happen at, you know, on 24th February at 5 a.m. So we actually knew the exact timing as well, you know, it's sort of based on U.S. intelligence. So then I think I stayed up till 2 a.m. and then I told my colleague Andrew Roth at The Guardian to call me when it happens. But of course, you hope that you never receive that call. You know, you hope that just never happens. But then, you know, I fall asleep, and 2 hours later, I get that call, and then you know, war started. There was it's a devastating feeling, because, you know, everything you know about your country will change, and the way you live will change, and the lives, of course, for millions of Ukrainians will change forever, which is most important in this whole story. But yeah, but the next, I don't know, week, 2 weeks, it was just constant work. You know, it's you sleep a bit and you go back to work and update your stories, the blogs, etc., futures. So yeah, there's definitely a moment where you know, I don't think I've ever worked as hard as in those 2 weeks, which kind of helped as well cope a bit with all the feelings of, I guess, you know, you feel powerless about this war, and at least with the work, you had an outlet where you could put your, I don't know, your thoughts in. I don't think I was ever demoralized in the beginning, because there was a lot of adrenaline at the beginning. You know, it was, you know, where the questions whether Ukraine as a state will survive, and, you know, what's going on next. So I think, no, as a journalist, there was just so much happening that I was never sort of demoralized or feeling like I didn't want to work. It was more, yeah, coping emotionally with these events that impact you, not just as a journalist, but as a person, as someone who has friends in Ukraine, as someone who knows the country as well. So yeah, it's something that you have to deal with. But I think as a journalist, you also know, I mean, these are the moments why you become a journalist, for these kind of, you know, tragic events, but this is when you're most needed. So you definitely feel motivated, you know, to tell the world what's going on.
And when have you left Russia?
I left Russia in the beginning of March. I think it's 7th or 8th of March. It's all a bit of a blur, that period. But at some point, you know, Russia introduced a series of laws criminalizing, you know, they call them fake news laws, right? That people could be charged with real prison sentences for not reporting the war the way the Kremlin wanted us to report. And there was a lot of insecurity about, you know, what does that mean for foreign journalists, not just for Russian journalists. And I think many foreign journalists decided to leave temporarily. And I did too. I flew to Istanbul first and then to Amsterdam. My plan was to return eventually. And then because other journalists started to return slowly, you know, I think Max and, you know, other people you talk to in this podcast have returned. I tried to return, but then I was waiting for the right documents from the foreign ministry. Bit of a bureaucratic problem. In the end, I did get them, but then my friend Evan Gershkovich got arrested, which is, if I'm speeding ahead, but after that, it sort of became for me clear that going back right now is not an option.
We will definitely talk about Evan a bit later, but now one more question about you. Have you got any messages or signals from intelligence that you have to leave, that it's not safe for you to stay, or it was your decision?
No, it was my decision. I think in early March, it was such a chaotic period that I think the Russian intelligence had other things to do than chasing us. But, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty whether the borders will close. You know, I think for Russian journalists, it wasn't even a question whether to leave or not, because for them, it was, you know, there was 100% danger that they could be jailed, and they started jailing other journalists. For us as foreign journalists, we always thought we're a bit more protected. But I think everyone just decided that for now it's better to leave and then see, you know, what's next. So no, I didn't get any threats, but you know, it was sort of in the chaotic atmosphere of that period, it was decided that it's better to leave for now.
Okay. And generally, how hard was it for you to work with sources, people talking to you off the record in Russia?
Oh, it was way, way easier before the war, before it became, you know, a criminal offense to talk to Western journalists. So now it's much more complicated. Back in the day, you could really talk to a lot of people who were unhappy for various reasons, you know, whether talking to doctors during the COVID crisis and them, you know, saying that they're being forced to work in very dangerous circumstances, you know, or just people in complaining about corruption or, you know, regular Russians. It was people were less scared during protests. People would give their full name. Now, experts would also, you know, give, you know, experts closer to the Kremlin would be open to talk to you. Now it's completely different. Now it's very hard to get people on the record. You know, sometimes you also think yourself whether, even if someone wants to go on the record, whether it's worth it, because you don't want to get them in trouble. You know, there's that extra layer of responsibility. So doing journalism is much, much harder now than it used to be, for sure. And trying to do honest journalism.
Do you think it's still possible to be a journalist in Russia today, you know, whether it's foreign journalist or a Russian journalist, is it possible?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. I think there are a few Russian journalists left, you know, a few brave friends of mine who are left. But in the end, they are, and they admit this, they are playing by the rules of the Russian government. You know, they're not calling the war and, you know, being careful with what they report. It's, of course, a choice they make. I think in their calculation, it's better to do that, but be able to tell the story from Russia than to leave. You know, I think there's definitely a grain of truth in what they say. On the other hand, you know, the rules of the government always change. So, you know, they might play by the rules today, but tomorrow those rules are different and they'll get in trouble. So, you know, I'm worried about them. With foreign journalists, in a way, it's even trickier, you know, after the arrest of Evan. It just shows that they can take anyone if they feel that's politically viable and needed at the time. You know, if they need a new person to trade in weeks or months, it doesn't really matter how you behave in Moscow. They could just take you. So I think it's a moral dilemma that many of us have. I mean, I would always like to report from the country as a journalist. You always understand what's going on better when you're inside. But, you know, you won't be able to tell your story if you're behind bars. And I think no story is worth it for you to, you know, to be imprisoned. So at this point, It's a complicated, everyone's making their own decision on.
I have one more question on that topic. Some young Russian journalists still living in Moscow or Petersburg or whatever, and they tell me that they write using a pseudonym. Is this actually an effective practice? I've heard that others are doing it as well. Do you know of any journalists yourself who are using pseudonyms and getting away with it?
Yeah, I think as a foreign journalist, that's not what we do. Like, we can't use pseudonyms. It's just not... I don't think The Guardian, I don't know any big outlet that does that. There's something to say for it, you know, if, of course, for a journalist in, you know, writing for Medusa, it's extremely dangerous to write under their own name. It's actually criminal according to Russian law because, you know, Medusa is a foreign agent and banned in Russia. So I understand why they do it. And I think they'll be able to get information out that we can't. But yeah, as I said, as a foreign journalist, we're not allowed to do it. I think there's some questions about credibility as well if you don't write under your own name. So there's all these sort of, again, moral dilemmas. But, you know, I think these people who are still in Russia, they have to be extremely careful because the Russian security services, they're always looking for new cases to start. And, you know, it's a machine that once it's started, it doesn't stop. And I think we're only going to likely see more arrests of journalists, activists, and human rights workers.
Now let's talk about Evan Gershkovich, the journalist from Wall Street Journal.
Should I tell what happened to him?
Tell us your version, how it happened, what you remember about those days.
Evan Gershkovich, who used to be my colleague at the Moscow Times. We worked 3 years closely together and became very, very close friends. He was reporting in Moscow, so he's one of the journalists he's American, who came back after the war started. He had the right documents. He was accredited with the foreign ministry. And he was on a reporting trip in Yekaterinburg on March 23rd, when they detained him in Yekaterinburg and charged him with espionage. He became the first American journalist to be charged with espionage since the end of the Cold War. His paper denied the charges. Evan denies the charges. I know that the charges are bogus. I think everyone who knows Evan as a journalist know they're bogus. Evan has never worked with the U.S. state. I mean, it sounds even bizarre to talk about it in that way. And since then, it's been almost 7 months. Evan has spent in a Russian cell in Moscow. He's still in pre-detention in the Fortova. It's a prison in central Moscow. It's very notorious for the way it isolates you and tries to break you mentally and physically. So it's been very tough on Evan. It's been tough on his friends and his family. But it, you know, I think by arresting him, the Russian authorities showed that they don't really play by any rules anymore. Foreign journalists back in the day, they had a special status. They were sort of protected. Worst case, what would happen? You know, you would be kicked out of the country. You lose your accreditation. But you could, you know, for majority people could do their work. I think Evan's arrest changed everything. And it seems like that he's being used as a, you know, pawn that the Kremlin's hoping to exchange him for a real spy that is in jail in the U.S. or anywhere else that they're looking for. So yeah, it's a very grim milestone for Russia, unfortunately.
So do you think he's just basically a hostage, or there is anything else behind that, and why did it happen to him?
He's 100% hostage. There's no denial. I mean, we don't know why exactly they targeted him over other journalists. We know he's American, which makes him more valuable. And there are very few Americans in the country at that time, American journalists. You know, Evan was a good journalist. He was going out to places. So maybe they decided to both, you know, catch a journalist that is exposing many problems for the Kremlin, you know, as a good journalist is, and at the same time use him as a hostage. But of course, all those spy charges are completely absurd. I mean, everyone who knows Evan will attest to that. And, you know, the government has not presented any evidence yet again in his case. And I know they won't be able to. So
do you think he will be free anytime soon?
Well, he will be free. The question is when, you know, unfortunately, espionage cases take a while before a sentence. Russia usually only exchanges American prisoners after their sentence. And from there, we hope that, you know, the U.S. State Department organizes an exchange as soon as possible. But, you know, I think Evan and we are prepared that this won't end very quickly. But in the end, we know that, you know, Russia wants to exchange him because they know he's not a spy and there's no use for him to be in a Russian jail.
Are there actual negotiations happening? I mean, is this even on the State Department's radar? Do you have any sense of that?
It is. I mean, Biden has publicly said that he's looking to exchange Evan as well as Paul Whelan. It's another U.S. citizen who's been in jail for a bit longer, for a few years in Russia, also on espionage charges. You know, Blinken has said it a few times. From the Russian side, they say they've said it and they sort of urge not to discuss it publicly because the negotiations happen behind closed doors. So it's definitely on the agenda. It's just that there are a lot of things on the agenda right now of the U.S., which, you know, the Middle East, elections coming up. So, you know, I think it's up to us to make sure that Evan stays in the agenda and that the U.S. Department knows that he needs to be freed. I mean, luckily, he works for a very powerful and, you know, prominent news organization that's also doing everything they can to, you know, to make sure Evan gets released.
Now, what do you foresee happening to Russia in 5 and 10 years from now?
Well, I'm a journalist. I'm not sort of a geopolitical analyst. I think as journalists, you always have to be careful not to make predictions. Otherwise, you look stupid going forward. But, you know, I think it's hard. I think the system for now looks stable. I don't see any signs that the Putin system will fall apart as long as he is, you know, in good health and in charge of the country. Of course, you know, bearing black swans and other events. I think if we look in the shorter term, I think a lot depends also on how the war in Ukraine goes. I think if Ukraine manages to, you know, to make a major breakthrough, that will create instability in Russia. If the war stays in a stalemate, that's only something that it's a favor for Russia. But I think in the end, knowing Russian and Soviet history, Russia goes through sort of these periods of relative freedom and relative unfreedom. And right now we're definitely in a period of unfreedom. So let's hope that, you know, it gets better and we'll see sort of some sort of democratization at some point, because there are a lot of young, smart Russians that would want to see their country get better and get more free.
How is Russian society going to look, you know, in your journalistic view? You know, is it going to just continue just being okay with this war, being okay with the state, the status quo, this normalization of everyday war? You know, what is going to happen to Russian society?
I think Russian society in general has been conditioned to be quite apolitical, you know, to be as little involved in state politics as possible. And if we look at polls, opinion polls on the war, that the majority of Russians say they don't actually follow the war. And, you know, that's, I think it's a comfortable condition for many Russians because, you know, they would rather just be left alone and not follow something that deep inside feels extremely nasty and uncomfortable. They know that your country is an aggressor and has invaded another country. So I think for many, you know, this state of sort of trying to just dissociate from what's going on outside works for now. You know, we see that people are extremely unhappy when this state is disrupted, like we've seen during the mobilization, when Putin called up 300,000 men, which is the first time sort of he actively asked Russians to participate in the war. And we saw what sort of effect it had on the country, with hundreds of thousands of Russians fleeing and other hiding. So I think, you know, as long as the Putin regime manages to keep this sort of dissociation between the war and what's going on this for normal people, then, you know, I think I'm not seeing any big changes. But, you know, I think that's why they're so scared of calling another mobilization. So I think if it becomes, you know, more totalitarian, where they actively ask Russians to participate in something they don't actually like, then we might see some unrest. And for young people, I think as long as, you know, young people have access to internet, to YouTube, to VPNs, they will be able to, you know, get new information, get different information. Same time, what we're seeing in schools is extremely worrying, where Russia is completely changing the education system, introducing these sort of pseudo-patriotic courses. And you know, I think that's one of the signs of a totalitarian country, of course, is education. And I think that's definitely a worry for now. The question is whether teachers go along with it. But if we do, you know, then we get a whole new generation that's sort of brought up on these anti-Western, anti-liberal ideas, which is a bit more worrying. But it's hard to say what response the sort of the youth will have on that. But we'll see.
You mentioned that you had worked in an embassy, you did some diplomatic work and such. As a non-American, what do you think the U.S. is doing wrong right now? And what should they be doing, you know, either through negotiations or how should they be approaching the situation with Russia, Ukraine, and also with Israel, Palestine? Like, all of it is deeply entangled. What should the U.S. be doing in your view?
Well, I think the U.S., I mean, from on a sort of a grassroots level, I think definitely should try to help Russian civil society, you know, by offering grants to Russian young journalists, students, you know, help Russian dissidents that want to flee, you know, Russian soldiers that don't want to fight. You know, it's a relatively cheap thing that they can do, but to really help, you know, smart young Russians that don't want to be part of the Putin regime. You know, I think that's definitely something they can do. I mean, on a broader level, you know, I think it's extremely complicated, the war in Ukraine at the moment, because we've reached a stalemate. You know, I think Ukraine will say that the U.S. should have armed them quicker, that Russia never really had any red lines, you know, that they should have given them the long-range weapons quicker, the planes quicker, and that way they could have forced something. You know, that's one way of looking at it. Maybe they're right. Same time, you know, Biden says that he's trying to be careful. So, you know, it's complicated. I don't think there's an easy answer, you know, but I think it's what they can do is, you know, keep the points of contact open with the Kremlin and with people around Putin who might start, you know, be sort of unhappy with the fact that this war is going on for so long, and who are also might be looking at regime change from within.
So along these same lines, do you think then that the Western world should be supportive of Russians who are emigrating and also even the Russian soldiers who defect and who leave the battlefield? I know you wrote a piece about that. And so, I mean, what is your view and how should America and the West in general, you know, treat Russian emigres?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge obviously difference between a soldier and an emigre. In general, but yeah, as I said, you know, I think those that actively leave the war, you know, because they're against the regime, they should get the Western help, you know, at least visa support and, you know, other ways for them to leave more easily. You know, Europe recently banned Russian cars from leaving the country, which I think was quite silly because, you know, it prevents a lot of Russians from leaving the country by car. With soldiers, I mean, this is a huge question. I think many pose themselves. Soldier, by definition, is not a war criminal in no war. If a soldier wants to leave the war, especially if he's been mobilized against his will, you know, or a contract soldier and he couldn't leave, I don't think I think they should go through the procedures of being checked, whether they've committed any war crimes. But if a soldier defects, I think he should be given, you know, by international law, he should be giving a safe haven and then go through all the checks. But it's definitely a complicated issue. And I understand why it's very emotional for Ukraine. You know, they don't want to see these Russian defectors be glorified either, you know, because these are the people that invaded their country. So it's an extremely sensitive subject, but I think it's clear that every soldier that isn't fighting in Ukraine means that he's not killing any Ukrainians, which, you know, is the main goal of, I think, the West and Ukraine.
When do you think you can come back to Russia and what should happen?
Oh, you know, I hope as soon as possible. But I need to know that it's safe for me, that it's not something that I just want to do for journalist reasons, but also just, you know, it's justified by the security and that it's in the country. I don't know whether it's under Putin or not under Putin. It's hard for me to say. Russia has surprised me before, but for now, I think I'm just trying to take it a step by the time and not think too much ahead.
Well, Piotr, thank you so much for your time. It has been amazing getting to talk to you and hearing your insights, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you. I hope that was interesting.
Slavic Connection is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this program represent the views of the hosts and the guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit us online at slavxradio.com. Thank you.
The Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies condemns the Russian Federation's military invasion of Ukraine. We stand in support of the people of Ukraine who are fighting for their lives and sovereignty in the face of the unjustified invasion by Russian military forces.
So, пока-пока.
Пока.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I'll text you how it goes.
I'll send you down.
Thank you. Bye-bye.